And Radio Derb is on the air. Our opening music this week was a snippet of the great Vladimir Horowitz playing the last movement of Mussorgsky's piano suite, Pictures at an Exhibition. Permit me to explain. Horowitz, generally regarded as the greatest concert pianist of the last century, Horowitz was born in Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine. And yes, I am suspending Radio Derb's usual toponymical conservatism here and saying Kyiv, not Kiev. Please don't be alarmed. I shall still favour Peking for the capital of China. Pictures at an Exhibition was inspired by, pictures that the composer saw at an exhibition in 1874. The pictures were by an artist who had died the year before and who had been a close friend of Mussorgsky. The particular picture that inspired this tenth movement of the suite was a sketch the artist had done for a monumental new city gate that the authorities wanted to build for Kyiv. As it happened, the gate was never actually built, but we still have the music. I'm obliged to a friend for all that, a guy who knows more about music than I ever shall. Last week's Radio Derb started off with the question, will he or won't he? After perusing some well-informed commentary from Russia experts, I came down on the side of, he will. Well, he did. So now the questions are, why did he? How will it play out? What effect will it have on us in the USA? The first question has two likely answers. First one, Putin wants to gather the Russian lands in the sense that Solzhenitsyn expressed 30 years ago, to bring the three Slavic republics, Russia, Belarus and Ukraine, along with Kazakhstan, all together in a unitary state. Belarus, as far as I can gather, is already there. It's just a Russian puppet state. Ukraine has been more resistant, hence this current assault. I don't know why Solzhenitsyn included Kazakhstan there, nor do I know anything much about the place, except that it's big, resource-rich, and moderately Russified. 20% ethnic Russian, mostly up along the border with Russia, according to Wikipedia. The second likely answer to question one is that Putin wants to recreate the USSR, the collapse of which he once called the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the century. That would be a more serious matter for the USA. The USSR included the Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. They are all now in NATO. So, under Article 5 of the NATO Treaty, if Putin were to attack them, we'd be obliged to join in defending them. Those of us who've been arguing for years that the USA should get out of NATO have been fond of posing rhetorical questions like, what proportion of US voters are willing to see our soldiers die fighting for Lithuania? And why is defending Lithuania's border with Belarus more important than defending our own southern border? If Putin is bent on recreating the USSR, these questions may not be merely rhetorical much longer. There is a third possible answer to question one, the question as to why Putin attacked, and that is because he wants to recreate the 19th century Russian Empire. That would certainly be in accord with Putin's great Russian nationalism. It would, however, mean reoccupying Poland. I seriously doubt Putin is contemplating that. There is also the possibility that Putin's ambition is actually less than to gather up the Russian lands. If you look at a map of Ukraine, it's divided into two pretty equal parts, the east and the west, by the river Dnieper. The Dnieper crosses Ukraine's northern border about halfway along, heading south. It flows through Kyiv, Ukraine's capital, then it turns through 45 degrees east down to Dnipropetrovsk, and then back westward out into the Black Sea, well west of Crimea. So, if Russia were to occupy just the part of Ukraine east of the Dnieper, that would give her a nice big river border and clear land passage to the Crimea and control of Kyiv. That would be a pretty good result by itself. We haven't heard much about Russian action in the western zone, although air raid sirens went off in Lviv this morning, on Friday. On those maps that we've been seeing with big red arrows for Russian units crossing into Ukraine, the arrows all cross east of the Dnieper. So, just possibly, Putin only wants the eastern half of Ukraine. That's not the way I'd bet, but it's possible. To the second question, how is this going to play out? My guess is as good as yours. The correlation of forces, of course, favours Russia, which is way bigger and has more stuff. 28 times the land area of Ukraine, 3.5 times the population. There are some imponderables, though. Ukrainians, at any rate outside those disputed regions furthest east, Ukrainians are fighting on their own land. So the old fox and rabbit cliche applies. The fox is running for his dinner, while the rabbit is running for his life. When you raise that in conversation, however, someone always points out that foxes nonetheless manage to keep themselves fed, which of course is true. From what I've been seeing this first couple of days, the Ukrainians aren't short of patriotic fighting spirit. President Zelensky seems willing to go down with the ship. This morning we got reports that on video conference last night with EU leaders, he told them, quote, "This might be the last time you see me alive," end quote. That is gutsy, if it's true. It likely is true. Zelensky's had plenty of time to flee the country, but he's still in Kyiv. And there are reports, although admittedly from the Ukrainian side, there are reports that captured Russian soldiers aren't happy about killing fellow Slavs. And there have been impressively large anti-war demonstrations in Russian cities. Impressively large and impressively brave. Russia is still an authoritarian state with a big and brutal secret police apparatus. We're seeing some brave people here on both sides. And then there is Putin's position among his peers, the people running Russia. Are there cliques and factions in the Russian leadership? Well, yes, of course there are. There always are. That's the nature of politics, including authoritarian politics. In fact, especially authoritarian politics, where there is total power to be played for. And the playing is being done without the scrutiny of an independent press. Is any of those factions strong enough to unseat Putin? I have no idea. In a secretive system of palace power like that, though, stuff happens. I don't expect to open my newspaper next Wednesday and see a headline, "Putin deposed." But I wouldn't be utterly astounded. All that said, it's hard to see how the Ukrainians can prevail, or even force any kind of stalemate. The betting has to be that President Zelensky and his family will be killed, along with a lot of other brave patriots. And a lot of other brave patriots will be shipped off to slave labour camps in Siberia. Which is awful. Someone should write an opera about it at the very least. Radio Derb's position is ethno-nationalist. In a just world, Ukrainians would have a country of their own. Putin should have left them the hell alone. We're a long way yet from that just world, but we can still speak up for it. An interesting sidebar issue here concerns China's reaction. Will a Russian success embolden the Chaicoms to attack Taiwan? I doubt it. The Chaicoms have their own plans for Taiwan, which, yes, surely include occupying it at some point and returning its people to the warm embrace of the motherland. They will carry out those plans on a schedule they've worked out long since, though. I doubt that a Russian triumph will do anything to accelerate that schedule. Most likely, the Chaicoms will take the opportunity to play the grave, serious, impartial adult in the room, possibly even going so far as to offer some slight, gentle criticisms of Putin's move. They love that pose. It's their second favourite pose, the favourite one being poor, pitiful but plucky victim China, determined to rise up again after 200 years of humiliation by the West. Behind the grave, serious, impartial pose, of course, the Chaicoms will be helping Putin all they can, in a common spirit of anti-Western mischief-making. Question 3 asked, what effect will this Russia-Ukraine war have on us in the USA? The effect could be pretty dire. A longish quote here from Dmitry Alperovich, writing in The Economist, February 25th. Longish quote. In the economic sphere, Russia can limit the export of strategic resources to the West, including grain, fertilizer, titanium, palladium, aluminium, nickel, and timber, to say nothing of possibly calamitous limits on oil and gas exports. Consider that Russia is the world's biggest exporter of fertilizer, without which food prices around the world would rocket. Over 70% of neon gas used in the sophisticated laser etching technology needed for manufacturing most semiconductors comes from Ukraine. Russia could easily stop its supply in the event of war. Mr. Putin could also take additional measures simply to make life difficult for Westerners, including banning overflight rights for Western airlines on routes to Asia. End quote. I did not know that about neon. Yes, one single chemical plant in the Ukraine, actually in Odessa, which is west of the Dnieper, one single plant supplies 65% of the world's production of neon. There's a trivial pursuit question for the ages. It's energy that people have been talking about most, though. Russia is a major exporter of energy in the form of oil and gas, and exporting energy is a major component of Russia's economy. It helps to state it like that as an equation with two sides, because the calculation to be made here is whether any kind of restrictions or embargoes on those exports hurt Russia more by depriving her of revenue, or her customers more by depriving them of energy. I don't know the answer to that, and I'm not sure anyone else does either. I do know, though, that we're in a much worse position than we need to be, energy-wise, because of extremely stupid decisions on the part of the Biden administration. Those decisions, shutting down the Keystone pipeline from Canada, banning fracking and new leases on federal lands, restoring regulatory obstacles that were scrapped by the Trump administration, they ended our energy independence at a stroke. It's commonly said that Biden carried out those actions because he's in thrall to the crazy green wing of his party, the people who tell us that the world will end if we don't stop burning fossil fuels. Well, maybe. Possibly Joe did have it in the back of his mind that it might be smart to appease the climate change cultists. At the front of his mind, however, was determination to reach the world of null T, the world in which nothing whatsoever remains of anything Donald Trump did in his presidency. It all had to be annulled, zeroed out, as if it had never happened. As I noted last August, quoting myself, remember those pictures from back then in January of Biden at his desk in the Oval Office, working through a big stack of Trump's executive orders, cancelling every one? Do you think he paused to read them? Do you think that now and then he thought, wait a minute, this one makes sense. Yeah, maybe we should keep it. Nope. He just ploughed through, cancelling everyone. If Trump did it, it's bad. Cancel it. The world of null T. End quote. There are some cultural aspects worth noting on the Russia-Ukraine war. This is the first national-scale war of Slavs against Slavs since the Poland-Russia bout 100 years ago. At any rate, it is, if you count the fighting when Yugoslavia broke up in the 1990s, as ethnic, not really national, which obviously I do. In that fighting, Russia seems mainly to have sided with the Serbs, perhaps seeing them as the closest of all their Slavic brothers down there, on account of belonging overwhelmingly to the Eastern Orthodox Church. And speaking of religion, I was surprised to learn that there may be a religious angle to Russia-Ukraine. Here's a quote from Giles Fraser at unheard.com, February 24th. Quote, "In 2019, the Ukrainian arm of the family of Orthodox churches declared its independence from the Russian Orthodox Church. And the nominal head of the Orthodox family, Bartholomew I of Constantinople, supported it. The Ukrainian president, Petro Poroshenko, described this as, in a quote, a great victory for the devout Ukrainian nation over the Moscow demons, a victory of good over evil, light over darkness," end in a quote, end quote. That has led to a good old-fashioned schism, although I don't believe the word filioque has played any part this time around. Putin is, of course, on the Russian side of this schism, and quite passionately so. His mother was a devout Christian, and according to Fraser, Putin sees himself as, quote, the true defender of Christians throughout the world, end quote. The Russian Orthodox Church is the focus of his spiritual loyalty, and Kyiv, where that church was founded in AD 988, is a key objective in the current military campaign. Another cultural aspect of this war is that it is the first of any significance to be fought in demographic modernity. By demographic modernity, I mean low fertility, declining workforce, swelling number of geezers. Russia's total fertility rate is 1.5, a tad better than it was in the disastrous 1990s, but not even close to replacement level. Population has been on a steady decline since 2020 and should have halved by the end of this century. Ukraine's in even worse demographic shape than that. David Goldman at Asia Times, a good reliable source for things like this, quotes 1.23 for the total fertility rate. Goldman also notes massive rates of emigration, with two-fifths of prime working-age Ukrainians earning their living abroad. The projection shows Ukraine's population well nigh disappearing by 2100. You can see the demographics at the very handy website populationpyramid.net. Clue: these populations are not shaped like pyramids. For pyramids, check out Afghanistan or Nigeria. All right, most advanced nations have population pyramids that aren't very pyramidy. Japan and the UK aren't fighting meat grinder wars with each other, though. As well as the cold statistics, there's a human angle to those numbers. Low TFR means one or two children as the norm, which means a half to one male children. Something to bear in mind when you see those pictures of young Ukrainian women in military fatigues. One more note on the cultural aspect, this one a crushing blow to Vladimir Putin. I see at the BBC website that Russia will not be allowed to compete in the Eurovision Song Contest this May. Let it not be said that the Europeans can't act in solidarity against Russian aggression. When I was a kid growing up in England in the years after World War II, there was regular news about the great economic successes of Germany and Japan. The adults all grumbled about this, saying, "We won the war, but it looks like we're losing the peace." I feel somewhat the same about the Cold War. We won it, no doubt about that. In the 30 years since, though, we really don't have anything to be proud of. Dumb, unnecessary wars with no victories. Ugly social divisions. Dumbed down schools and colleges. Politicised justice. It's been 30 years of folly and decline. Browsing Twitter the other day, I came across a kindred spirit. A tweeter who feels the same way I feel about our post-Cold War trajectory. This is Carlo Lancelotti, Professor of Mathematics at the College of Staten Island. Ah, you can depend on a mathematician for clear-sightedness. Here was Professor Lancelotti in a multi-part tweet on Thursday. His theme, quote, "Thinking of the top 10 follies perpetrated by the Western ruling class during my adult life," end quote. I hope the good professor won't mind if I just quote his top 10 follies. Here we go, slightly edited. 1. Deindustrializing / impoverishing / oxycontifying vast regions of the USA out of an entirely ideological commitment to free trade. 2. Making most of Western Europe dependent on Russian energy imports out of an entirely ideological rejection of nuclear power. 3. Trying to extend NATO to the River Don Basin out of only God knows what. 4. Aiding and abetting demographic collapse and mental health epidemics by embracing even the most pathological outcomes of the 1960s sexual revolution. 5. Corrupting the educational system by pushing universal credentialism and the politicization of education. 6. Creating enormous loads of public debt and implicitly debasing the currency in order to protect a phony financialized economy and vast unchecked monopolies. 7. Wasting trillions of dollars and thousands of lives in useless, grinding conflicts in Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, etc. 8. Destroying the European unification project by depriving it of any ideal content and making it a tool of techno-bureaucratic control. 9. Splitting the USA in two by promoting universal politicization and cultural / economic / racial segregation. 10. Starting World War III to cover their asses after people got angry about 1 through 9. And then in parenthesis he says, "Let's hope not." There are some nits that you can pick there, but it's not a bad summary. We elect our ruling classes to think up and execute policies to the national advantage, for the general security and prosperity of all citizens and the improvement of our lives. What we actually get is stupidity, waste, and lies. Isn't there some way we can figure to get a better ruling class? One that's selfless, patriotic, and smart? Or does the stupidity lie with us, that we keep electing these numbskulls? I'm just wondering. So much for the war over there. How about the war over here? I mean, of course, the cold civil war between good whites and bad whites, Tutsis and Hutus, between urban college-educated progressives and mean, unwashed good old boys with guns, Bibles and pickup trucks. In relation to this, I note that tomorrow, Saturday, is February 26th, the 10th anniversary of George Zimmerman shooting Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida. That shooting was, I think, a key milestone on the road to the extraordinary anti-white racial hysteria of today. Among other things, it gave us the fashionable and extremely well-financed anti-white terrorist organisation Black Lives Matter, which came into existence following Zimmerman's acquittal at trial in July 2013. That trial was reasonably well conducted, in spite of efforts by the media, notably NBC, to edit Zimmerman's phone calls to make him sound anti-black. The main effort to rig the trial against Zimmerman came from Benjamin Crump, attorney for Martin's family. Trayvon Martin had been on the phone with his girlfriend right up to the final struggle. That girlfriend, however, was unwilling to testify in court, so Crump used her half-sister, Rachel Jean Tell, as a substitute. This backfired, though, Rachel Jean Tell being such a poor witness that her mumbled, incoherent testimony was probably a key factor in getting Zimmerman acquitted. This wasn't as much of a setback to the anti-white Tutsi establishment as it might have been, as Zimmerman was not, in fact, very white. His mother is an immigrant from Peru, part indigenous. His first language was Spanish. His great-grandfather was black. Not really an authentic Hutu. Fate has recently been much kinder to the anti-whites. It gave them, in succession, the Brunswick Three, Derek Chauvin, and Kimberly Potter. Taking the last case first, Kimberly Potter is the white female Minneapolis police officer who drew her pistol in error, thinking it was her taser. She shot a black perp. Last Friday, she was sentenced for first and second degree manslaughter. She got a 2-year sentence, although there's a good case to be made that what she did was lawful homicide. And I'll be interested to see what happens on appeal. Derek Chauvin was likewise a white police officer accused of unlawfully killing a black perp. The Brunswick Three, Greg and Travis McMichael and Roddy Bryan, were Hutu males right out of central casting, working class Georgians with, yes, guns and a pickup truck. They too were accused of unlawfully killing a black person. Show trials were duly staged. Derek Chauvin and the Brunswick Three being tossed into the volcano to appease the diversity god. This week saw further developments in both cases. The defendants in the Derek Chauvin case, you could call the Minneapolis Three. They are the three police officers who were present with Chauvin when George Floyd went to his reward. They have a state trial scheduled for this June on charges of aiding and abetting the unlawful killing of Floyd. What we had this week was a verdict on Thursday on the federal civil rights charges against the three. And no, this is absolutely, totally not double jeopardy. If you think so, you are at best a pitiful ignoramus with no understanding of the law, and at worst, probably a Nazi. The verdict on the Minneapolis Three was, of course, guilty. Sentencing procedures will start next week. Then in June, the state trial, which, once again, will not be an instance of double jeopardy. No way. Absolutely not. Finally, the Brunswick Three, all of whom were sentenced to life in prison last November on state charges of having murdered famous jogger Armaud Arbery. Tuesday this week, they got the federal treatment. All were found guilty of federal hate crimes and attempted kidnapping. I get the hate crimes thing. It means having bad thoughts, right? I can't understand the attempted kidnapping charge, though. I followed this case pretty closely, and I can't recall any point at which the defendants grabbed Arbery and tried to tie him up and drag him away. I guess kidnapping means something else in Georgia law. Hailing a guy on an open street and asking him to stop so you could talk to him, perhaps. What's that you say? Double jeopardy? Oh, shut up, for goodness sake. You don't know anything. As if the show trials of the Brunswick Three weren't appalling enough, the Georgia State Legislature has topped them off with a nasty little insult. They have passed a resolution designating February 23rd, the date of Armaud Arbery's passing, to be celebrated this year and forever after in the state of Georgia as Armaud Arbery Day. One of the co-sponsors of the resolution, I note, was a Republican, Don Hogan. Yeah, that's the GOP we know and love. The legislature's resolution encourages celebrants to run 2.23 miles on that day to advocate for racial equality. That is, of course, in addition to burning votive candles and prostrating themselves before images of the deceased. Who says religion is disappearing from our public life? And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. Something to look forward to? Next Tuesday at 9 p.m, our president will deliver his first State of the Union address. I keep advising presidents to revert to the more traditional method of just having the address typed up and mailed to the Congress critters, but they don't listen. In Joe Biden's case, he really should have. With the best teleprompter in the world, this is going to be embarrassing to watch. A guy who can barely remember to put verbs in his sentences, trying to make bad news sound good. Well, enjoy. I'm going to have to miss it. Tuesday's the evening I give the family dog his enema. Item. As expected, President Biden has nominated Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court. This is the black female he promised us. I don't doubt that she's as progressive as all get out. But from what I've read, she is not as dumb as Sonia Sotomayor. So there is that. What's her confession, though? The present court is 2 Jews and 7 Catholics. If she's Catholic too, then when she takes Breyer's place, it'll be 8 Catholics and 1 Jew. What are we Protestants, chopped liver? Why can't we have a court that prays like America? Item. I intended to close with some remarks about the Winter Olympics, which closed on Sunday in Peking. I did my best with the games. I even managed to watch a few minutes of curling before I lost the will to live. Now I step up to the line, though, I can't think of a thing to say. In lieu of my own thoughts, therefore, I will quote you the summary from the New York Times, February 20th. Quote, "For all of China's efforts to carry on the Winter Games with a festive spirit, Beijing 2022 unfolded as a joyless spectacle, constricted by a global health disaster, fraught with geopolitical tensions, tainted once again by accusations of doping, and overshadowed by the crisis in Ukraine." End quote. A joyless spectacle. I think that sums it up perfectly. That's all I have, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening. And if you missed Armored Arbery Day on Wednesday, remember that tomorrow is Trayvon Martin Day, so you can observe that in lieu. It's not official yet, but I feel sure it soon will be. I heard a faint rumbling close behind me from Time's Winged Chariot this week, hearing that Gary Brooker died last Saturday. Brooker founded the pop group Procol Harum back in 1966. The following year, the group had a mega hit with the song A Whiter Shade of Pale. Brooker was English by birth and just 4 days older than me. Hence that faint rumbling. Or perhaps it was only indigestion. Whatever. Rest in peace, Gary. There will be more from Radio Derb next week.
Seasick. The crowd called out for more. The room was humming harder as the ceiling flew away. When we called, we'll be right back. told his tale, that her face at first just ghostly.